and ask our brother Mike Mastrovic to come forward and continue leading us in the study of the book of Esther.
Well, good evening, everyone. I think we must say that the Word of God is truly incredible when we study it. And we're always thankful for being able to have the opportunity to study sections that we may not have gone into as much depth in before. And we start to see, as we will go through this evening, the amazing intricacy and how intertwined the Word of God is all throughout His scriptures. And I want to thank Brother Bob for his discussions this evening, because no other topic could probably have intertwined and dovetailed quite so nicely as the subject of the Amalekites, as we'll come to that, because they also affected the events that happened in the books of Esther. So last week we spent most of our time together pretty much reviewing some background issues in this book. We sort of highlighted the period within which the events were occurring. We looked at who the king possibly was, and we took a look at who Esther was, what we knew about Esther. And we defined what her Hebrew name was, Hadassah. We talked about how it meant Myrtlewood. And actually, Brother Ken passed me a clock that he happened to make. And he told me that it's made out of myrtle wood. So if you're interested in coming to see it, I understand it's a hardwood. It's a very nice-looking wood as well. So Brother Ken's got some myrtle wood. You're welcome to come have a look. Thank you for that. We also looked at Hadassah's Persian name, which we know her by more commonly as Esther, and that name meant star. So we covered a number of things relating around the book, and tonight we want to get more in depth into some of the specifics in this wonderful book of Esther. Now, one thing that we would like to do, we kind of rushed at the end last week. I'm not going to do any other review other than if I might indulge you for a few minutes on some of the comparisons of the account of Esther with the account of Joseph. I had it rather undeveloped last week, and we went through it rather quickly. So I'd like to just, as we get ourselves immersed into this study once again, let's just consider some of the attributes that we've seen that are similar between these two different accounts. We talked last week that there were similarities both in style, but also in specific subject matter. Some of the verses, the language used was almost identical. So clearly the writer had the book of, or the story of Joseph in mind as well when some of these things were being penned. So we're going to cover the fact that both stories took place in a foreign country. We know that Joseph's story was in Egypt, and of course Esther's in the Persian Empire days. And both of them begin their path against their will. We talked that Joseph was sold by his brothers. Later on, we know he was thrown into jail for being accused of something that he didn't do. Esther herself being forcibly taken into the king's palace. So we have an example of similarity where they're both drawn into this against their will. And we also talked last week that they both had a continued and rather dramatic rise to their position of power. So, and through with Joseph's case, it was through the interpretation of Pharaoh's dream, and in Esther's through finding the king's favor. Now, I also picked up on a few other similarities in the past week as we were doing this. When we think of the fact that the 12 tribes, really only two of the children came through through Rachel, in the sense that Joseph and Benjamin, Rachel only had two children. So in the two stories, Joseph formed one of the lines, and Benjamin, which we know that Mordecai and Esther were from this line, so we can see that there's a common motherhood in their accounts as well. We also would note that both stories, if we think about the turning point in those stories for each of those individuals, it's a result of a lack of sleep or something occurring in your sleep. So in Joseph's case, we remember that Pharaoh had this very troubling dream and he couldn't make sense of it. And that's what Joseph was called to interpret, and his life was turned around at that point for him. And in Esther's case, the king was having trouble sleeping, as we'll remember. And so he had some of his servants read to him some of the things that were recorded in his chronicles. So those were both turning points in each of the stories. Too many clicks to do here. So the other point, this is probably getting a little minor here in the points, but they were both given names of the foreign countries and which they live. So Joseph's name was named Zaphnath-Paneah, as we know, and Hadassah was named Esther. And we talked about the fact that her name Esther means star. But one thing we didn't mention last week, and we'll expand on it a little this week, the closest Hebrew equivalent for star, the word in the Hebrew means hidden. And so we'll get a sense of the fact that in many ways Esther lived up to that name of being hidden in some of the events that take place. And lastly on this little piece, both of them really hid their identities, if you think of it. Joseph didn't reveal himself to his brothers until he called a small banquet. And that's what the exact same thing that Esther did. She called this second banquet, and then she let the king as well as Haman know that of her identity. So those are some fairly obvious similarities we see between these two accounts. Now, if we compare some passages now, I had these in a chart last week, and now I've put them up for us in a little bit more easily readable form, so we're not having to flip through the Bible. In Genesis 39, verse 6, we read that Joseph was handsome in form and appearance. And we know that about Joseph, but we also know last week we read about Esther's beauty. But the language, again, is very, very similar. Esther 2:7. Now the young lady was beautiful in form and face. So very, very similar language. And this account in Genesis 39 was Potiphar's wife, remember, speaking to Joseph. It says, as she spoke to Joseph day after day, he did not listen to her, to lie beside her or to be with her. And we compare that language with that of Esther chapter 3, when Mordecai is not bowing down to Haman, and the other servants around him are asking him, why aren't you doing this? They say in Esther 3:4, now it was when they had spoken daily to him, and he would not listen to them, that they told Haman to see. So the language in the original from day after day is very similar to spoken daily to him, and in both cases he would not listen. So again, we looked at that one last week as well. We looked briefly at this one in Genesis 41, where it says, Pharaoh took off his signet ring from his hand and put it on Joseph's hand and clothed him in garments of fine linen, put the gold necklace around his neck, and had him ride in his second chariot. And then they proclaimed before him, bow the knee, and he set him over all the land of Egypt. And if we compare that with Esther chapter 8, verses 2 and verses 15, we see a striking similarity again. The king took off his signet ring, which he had taken away from Haman, and gave it to Mordecai. Esther set Mordecai over the house of Haman. And then Mordecai went out in the presence of the king in royal robes. So again, we have the adorning of royal robes of blue and white and a large crown of gold and a garment of fine linen and purple. And also you'll see similarities back to Genesis if you go and look at Esther 10. It's only three verses, but again, the language almost identical to the language used here in Genesis 41. Another passage that says that Jacob tore his clothes and put sackcloth on his loins and mourned his son for many days. So we remember in Genesis 37 when Jacob heard that, or he believed that his son Joseph was dead, that this is what he did. He tore his clothes and put sackcloth. And we compare it with Mordecai learning of what Haman had just decided to do. It says when Mordecai had learned all he'd done, he tore his clothes, put on sackcloth and ashes, and went out into the midst of the city and wailed loudly and bitterly. So another very close similarity we find. We also looked briefly at this one last week from Genesis 43. When Jacob, under the having to make a decision about whether to let Benjamin go with the rest of his children in order to prove to this man whom they didn't know was Joseph yet, that he in fact did have another son, faced with starvation, he reluctantly lets his son Benjamin go, and he says, and may the God Almighty grant you compassion in the sight of man, so that he will release to you your other brother and Benjamin. And as for me, if I am bereaved of my children, I am bereaved. And again, the similar passage that we looked at was when Esther, again, faced with a decision to risk her life, to save potentially save her people, she decides to do it, and she uses that familiar language. We won't read the whole thing, because in Esther 4, verse 16, we read that famous section which says, where she concludes, I will go into the king, which is not according to the law, and if I perish, I perish. So again, we saw the similarities in language between these two. Now lastly, in Genesis 41, verse 34, it says, this was when Joseph was interpreting the dream of Pharaoh. He's explaining how to implement some of the things that he was talking about. Joseph says, let Pharaoh take action to appoint overseers in charge of the land, and let him exact a fifth of the produce of the land of Egypt in the 7 years of abundance. So he was telling Pharaoh that he was to pull in the grain, to gather it into the storehouses in Egypt, so that they could be given out in the years of drought. Well, we can compare that passage with Esther 2, verse 3, we read this evening, where it says, let the king appoint overseers in all the provinces of his kingdom, that they may gather every beautiful young virgin to the citadel of Susa, to the harem, into the custody of Haggai, the king's eunuch, who is in charge of the women. And it makes us wonder, when we consider the number of passages that the similarities are made here, that whether the writer of Esther here is making a likeness to the gathering of grain of Joseph into the storehouses to be used as at the king's discretion. And this might really be an allusion to how the king in Esther's day would have viewed these young women who, as wheat being brought into the palace. Something for us to consider. Now we want to make a few other comparisons while we're on the issue of making comparisons in the story. Esther compared to Sarah. I think, again, we're following the beauty theme. We know that Sarah, I think she's listed in Jewish literature as one of the top four beautiful women of Israel. And Esther's right up there as well. We know that both of them were very beautiful. So in terms of a comparison, Genesis 12 gives us some insight into that. Remember that Abram was concerned when he went into Egypt that he'd be killed because his wife was so beautiful. And so he said, you know, tell them that you're my sister. We are all familiar with that story. And he does it again in Genesis 20 when he goes to Abimelech, king of Gerar. And not only were they both beautiful, they were both brought into the house of rulers. So right after the account in Genesis 10, Genesis 12, in verse 15, we know that Esther was in fact brought in to Pharaoh's house. And also in Genesis 20, Abimelech also took Sarah. So, and then in Esther, we know obviously of her account that she was brought into the house. So there's two comparisons that I think we can make. Now, this one is maybe a little unusual, but something for us to consider. Sarah lived 127 years, tells us in Genesis 23:1, that was her age. So the comparison there is Esther ruled over 127 provinces. It's the only time that I can find that number used in Scripture in any other case. So we're trying to make a connection between the 127 years that Sarah lived. And maybe we can speculate if we're permitted. Sarah was obviously the matriarch, the first Jewish woman being described. And Esther, being a descendant of Sarah, I think we can say she's the last Jewish woman that I can think of that is described in terms of her character and her form. So wondering if we might suggest that Sarah's life being a full life, 127 years, she begins a nation, and whereby we later see through a marriage to a king, that there is a reigning over all the earth, the entire empire of Persia. There was a reigning that was taking place. Because we'll see a little bit later that Esther has been compared with the true bride of God. She's been compared to a nation that was meant to be an adornment of him. Esther gave her people a hope. And we are also, being the bride of Christ, have a similar hope. So again, something for us just to think about. Now what we want to do is to get into some of the specific details of the book of Esther. And we've got some slides and we're going to cover in some degree all of the chapters at a rather fast pace, obviously, to get through all 10. But I think that we are quite familiar with the story, so I'm going to try and pick on areas that we might not be as familiar with or areas that we might not have considered. Now, chapter 1 we read last week, and we spent a little bit of time looking at which king it was, so we're not going to spend any more time looking at anything to do with the king. I didn't know that I wanted to touch much to do with eunuchs. I did a little bit of reading on eunuchs, only to the extent of learning that the process involved would not have been very pleasant. The tools that they used weren't very sophisticated. There's not really a lot known that I could see about eunuchs, more in the Oriental culture, but in this culture there wasn't a lot that was known about eunuchs or in terms of how they did. But I think we do know that the chief reason that the king utilized eunuchs was to care for all of his women, his concubines. And the most obvious reason for that would be that it was always a problem for rulers when children were born and whether those children were really from the king's line and lineage, because those would be obvious potential heirs to the throne. And so the king himself would not want to have any doubts cast as to who the actual child was. And so he had these eunuchs ruling or caring for his ladies, I guess, as we might say, in his various concubines and various rooms that they lived in. So I think that's all we were going to say on the topic of eunuchs. And we were introduced in chapter 1 to this Queen Vashti as well. And the one thing that I took from Brother John Knowles' book on Esther, this his study, that I thought we might include here tonight is that he suggests that we might see Vashti as a type of Israel after the flesh. We know that in Jeremiah, the prophet says, "Behold, the days are coming, declares the Lord, when I will make a new covenant with the house of Israel and with the house of Judah, not like the covenant which I made with their fathers in the day I took them by the hand to bring them out of the land of Egypt. My covenant which they broke, although I was a husband to them." And so we see the language of the husband to the bride, declares the Lord. And in the prophet saying that the bride isn't falling through with the covenant that they should have. Isaiah, in Isaiah 54, verse 5, also he says, "For your husband is your maker, whose name is the Lord of hosts. And your Redeemer is the Holy One of Israel, who is called the God of all the earth." And so we see and we know that Israel is depicted as the bride of God, and God desiring that his people should be a crowning adornment of his glory. And Vashti did not hearken to the words of her husband, nor did the people to their God. And as a result, the king will seek a new bride, just as God sought a new bride, one who will reveal the characteristics befitting the wife of a king. So chapter 2. So as we go through this, you may want to have our Bibles open into Esther, because we're going to pick on some of the highlights as we go through the chapters. It'll be easy to glance down. The first thing about chapter 2 that we note is that a new queen is sought. We read that this evening. And we want to just think for a moment, though, about how the process was done to achieve this. Because we know that there was precedent for this before, wasn't there, in Israel? David, remember in 1 Kings chapter 1, that when David was old, And he couldn't get warm, you know, and his servant said, "Well, we should go into the land of Israel and find a young maiden for him to be his wife." And they select Abishag, don't they? So we know that there was some precedent in Israel for doing this, but we also note the difference between how this process was done. It looks like in this case, all the women were brought into the harem, and by inference, all the women were probably tried to determine whether they were worthy of a queen. And yet, in David's case, well, in fact, they only brought one to David, and we know that David was never with Abishag. But we do know, we're just bringing up the example of David and the fact that this was done in Israel. Now, I want us to just take a look for a moment about, again, thinking of the process, because I think I used to sort of think in the discussions that we have about, oh, this is what a nice thing, you know, to come in and be selected as the queen and have a year of preparation and beauty treatments and, you know, but if we really think about what happened and in fact the thousands, in likelihood, of at least hundreds of women that would have also been in there, that would have gone to the second harem, that we read of in verse 14. I should actually open my own notes to, we consider that there was really a period of, I'm not sure exactly, but anywhere from 2 to 3.5 years, between the time when we're first given dates, when Esther was ousted and when Esther was selected. There's about a 4-year period. So we wonder how many others had come before the king before Esther was selected. And then, if we just think for a minute on verse 19 as well, there's a different way of looking at this passage, I think. In verse 19, when the virgins were gathered together the second time, and there's the obvious way of reading it, because, I mean, the account is after Esther's, the wedding took place, the king gave a banquet and so on, and all the virgins came back a second time. But I wonder also if, given the length of time that has taken place, and given the practices of the kings, whether this wasn't in fact a second calling of new virgins in the land to bring them back into the concubines, and to make preparations. The only reason we mention that is because we want to come back to that in a little while, because it speaks, I think, to the faith that Esther must have had and the shaky position that she was in her circumstances. So we also wanted to just comment for a minute on waiting for a year. And again, we talked about they had 6 months of a certain treatment and 6 months of another. Well, given the fact that most things in the life of the king were for his benefit, and not likely for these young ladies' benefit, we want to just think, was this just purely a time for beautification? I think the other reason why the time frame is because they went into all the land, and obviously the married ones weren't ones he was selecting from. He was pulling all the beautiful ones who were unmarried, and the way for him to determine whether they'd been with a man before was to wait at least a year, because in that time, if they had, there's all likelihood that they could be giving birth. So just something for us to think about was, again, another reason why that period of a year comes up. Because we think that it could have benefited the king in many ways, again, on the legitimacy of the offspring coming from the woman. We also know in chapter 2 that Esther finds favor. But what really is the favor that she gets under a godless king? I mean, we talked about how many women had gone before, and possibly if we can make the argument in verse 19 about a second gathering, those would be coming after her. We know she, when she went to go to the king, she hadn't seen him for 30 days. So we mention, again, we're talking about this because we're building up to a point that we'll be coming to in a moment. But also in chapter 2, at the very end, Mordecai overhears a plot to go against the king. And we just want to think whether presumably the number of languages were spoken and how Mordecai understood the particular discussion that was taking place makes us wonder. And just wanted to note that in the Jewish tradition, anyways, is that Mordecai was a member of the Sanhedrin, and as a member of the Sanhedrin had to know upwards of 60 to 70 different languages. So that's just speculation and tradition, but something for us to consider. And also we know at the very end that once the plot was investigated to be true, that the men were hung, and then the events were recorded in the King's Chronicles. So, chapter 3, we are introduced to this man named Haman. And we want to think for a minute on who this Haman is, and where did he come from? Well, there's been some suggestion that Haman was in fact Memucan from chapter 1. You'll note if you go back to chapter 1 that Memucan was one of the seven princes in Persia, verse 14. He was the one who recommended to that Vashti did wrong and that a royal decree be issued. It tells us in verse 21 of chapter 1 that this word pleased the king and princes, and the king did as Memucan proposed. And again, it's only a suggestion, but in chapter 3, verse 1, it says that he promoted Haman above all the princes, and all the princes, again, were listed in chapter 1. So there is a suggestion that there's a possibility that this man now named Haman could have been that which was Memucan from chapter 1. Now this is where we dovetail so wonderfully with what Brother Bob was talking about this evening. It tells us that Haman was an Agagite. And do we remember who Agag was the king of? In 1 Samuel 15, Agag was the king of the Amalekites. Let's just turn to 1 Samuel 15. Remembering what was prophesied about them in Exodus 17, when the Lord, it says, the Lord has sworn, the Lord will have war against Amalek from generation to generation. 1 Samuel 15. And we reminded here that Samuel says to Saul, the Lord has sent me to anoint you king over his people, over Israel. Now listen to the words of the Lord. Thus says the Lord of hosts, I will punish Amalek for what he did to Israel. And how he set himself against him on the way, was coming up from Egypt. Now go and strike him and utterly destroy all that he has. And we know that Saul started to do this, but he only went so far because apparently they had some fairly nice sheep. They had some fairly nice things for that the people wanted to keep and not utterly destroy. And we know also in verse 8 of 1 Samuel 15 that he captured Agag, the king of the Amalekites, alive. So there's Agag, the king of the Amalekites. But Saul, it says in verse 9, and the people spared Agag, best of the sheep, oxen, fatlings, lambs, and all that was good, and were not willing to destroy them. So again, they did not listen to the word of the Lord. And that's when Samuel, we know in that account, God tells him that he regrets that he made Saul king, and that he would give that kingdom to someone else as Saul tears Samuel's robe. So we see in this passage the fact that it was this particular instance against Agag that Saul lost his kingship. Okay? So back into Esther. What tribe was Saul from? Sorry? Benjamin. Who was he the son of? The son of Kish. Okay? So we also note here in Esther that Mordecai and Esther were not only from Benjamin, but they were also from Kish. So Saul was the first king of Israel, tribe of Benjamin. This handsome son of Kish was removed as king of Israel because of this one incident with Agag. We realize that Saul was removed because of the fact that he didn't listen to God. But obviously, even though Samuel killed Agag at the time, he must have in some way had the opportunity to continue on his line, because we read in other passages of Amalekites, but here an Agagite specifically. So here we have in Esther now, their foe, their number one enemy of the nation of Israel is an Agagite. I mean, think how beautiful it is, really, that Esther and Mordecai are now to redeem their tribe from the error of their ancestor Saul. By demonstrating the righteousness of God. And if only Saul had listened. And this account in Samuel puts new life for us in the expression of Mordecai when he says to Esther in chapter 4 and verse 13 and 14, do not imagine that you, Esther, will be able to escape the king's palace any more than the rest of the Jews. For if you perish in keeping silent at this time, relief and deliverance will come to the Jews from another place, while you and your father's house will perish. And who knows whether it was just for such a time as this that you attained royalty. And in Saul's case, relief and deliverance came by way of Mordecai and Esther. And if it wasn't them, we know, because God is always faithful to his promise, that it would have been through someone else. In Haman, we see that, we'll start to see that in this chapter, that really his chief downfall is his ego. His own ego and his view about his self-importance. And again, the fact, I think we could also say Haman, being an Agagite, being an Amalekite, and as Brother Bob suggested, representing sin at its maximum. And this hatred becomes so great that he approaches the king to have an entire nation of people wiped out. So, why didn't Haman bow down? Well, we saw in 1 Samuel 15 and back in Exodus 17. Oh, sorry. Why didn't Mordecai bow down? Yeah, sorry. Because under the law, Amalekites were cursed. Also, we know that reverence to any man was forbidden. And the very last piece in chapter 3 in Esther, it tells us, after the decrees went out, the couriers went out impelled by the king's command, while the decree was issued at the citadel. While the king and Haman sat down to drink, the city of Susa was in confusion. So why was the city of Susa in confusion? Well, if King Darius was in fact the king that we're talking about, and the same king as we find in Ezra chapter 6, you'll remember that he had a law to support, to protect, and to enable the Jews of the land to return to their land and to worship their God. And so this law now, enacted by the king through Haman, was contrary to this previous law. Now, this picture, again, it's always hard to get a three-dimensional picture onto a two-dimensional image. But this is actually a cube, this picture. And in chapter 3, we also note that the lots were cast in order to pick a date. This cube has an inscription on it, and with the names of a man titled Yali, who was the chief steward of Shalmaneser, king of Assyria. And they deciphered this to be a prayer. And it says in his year assigned to him by lot, or by Puru, which is what the text says, may the harvest of the land of Assyria prosper. And it goes on. So they because of the fact that this is, in a couple instances, uses that phrase Puru, we think that this is a suggested prototype it's the only one that I understand has been recovered, for how the lots are cast by Haman to fix a date for the destruction of the Jews. And we know that the method of selection was, it tells us that Haman went day by day and month by month. So it was as if they were either some form of dice or cube or something which came up with a certain day, and then they went to the months and picked, and that was the fortuitous day that they determined. Now, I wanted to just also think for a moment on the significance of the date. What was the significance? What date was it that they sent out the news to the nations? It seems significant to me because the fateful day that this was distributed in verse 12, chapter 3, was the 13th day of Nisan. The Jewish people that chose to remain outside of their promised land should have been focused on the Passover. This was the Passover period for them. And so it seems to be a wonderful picture for us of the fact that they should have been remembering their Passover lamb. They should have been remembering their need for redemption. Without this, they were doomed to destruction. And in fact, that's the day they found out that their nation would be doomed to destruction. Now, I wanted to also suggest that the events in Esther were prophesied about in Isaiah. If you turn to Isaiah chapter 17, it says in Isaiah 17 verses 12 to 14, "Woe to the multitude of many people, which make a noise like the noise of the seas and the rushing of nations. The nations shall rush like the rushing of many waters, but God shall rebuke them, and they shall flee far off. They shall be chased off as the chaff of the mountains before the wind, and like a rolling thing before the whirlwind. And behold, at the eventide, trouble, and before the morning, he is not. That is the portion of them that spoil us, and the lot of them that rob us." And in the text below is the word on the second word from the right is the phrase that's translated multitude, the multitude, in that top verse, woe to the multitude. And the Hebrew pronunciation of that is hamon. And if we consider the fact, if we replace that language, woe to hamon of many people, which make a noise like many seas, to rushing of nations. The nations were to rush against Israel and to attack the Jews. And not only that, they were allowed to plunder and rob them, weren't they? But not before God comes to their rescue. It says here in Isaiah that God shall rebuke them and they shall flee from afar off. We know that's what happens in the end of Esther. They flee like from before the wind. And in this passage it says, behold, at eventide, trouble. Remember when it was that when Haman was found coming to the king asking for remembrance or to hang Mordecai on the gallows. He was coming in the middle of the night when the king couldn't sleep. Behold, at the eventide, trouble. And instantly, though, he was to go out and put Mordecai on that horse. And he was, after that, he was immediately drawn to the meal where he was not. He was hung. And then before the morning, he is not, it says. Just something for us to think about, whether that is, we can say that Esther was in fact prophesied about the events taking place in Isaiah. I see my time's running out and my father-in-law has to pick up his dear wife. So he may have to duck out and I'll have to close because I was supposed to preside tonight anyway. So in case you see him get up, I know he won't be, it's not because he's offended. Chapter 4, we will be going a little faster speed now, though, as we come to some of these events. Mordecai's reaction, we won't actually spend a lot of time. I've read it once already, but chapter 4 has these two highlights, doesn't it? Where Mordecai finally realizes all the fact that he wasn't bowing down. The nation of Israel, as a result, was going to be punished and killed. Mordecai has that famous and moving passage in verses 13 and 14, where he says, "Who knows whether you've not attained royalty for such a time as this?" And chapter 4 also has Esther's decision to go. "If I perish, and I perish." And this is where I just wanted for us to consider a little bit more that would have been going into her decision. Because we talked about her position, the shaky position that she might have had. She saw what happened to Vashti for refusing an order of the king. We get a sense of distance in how the king selects his queen, forcing women into his harem. We know also that the king hadn't seen her in 30 days. And then we just read that passage, or we suggested that other passage where he might have called in some new concubines. And she's wondering whether she's still in favor or not, or whether it's just a matter of time before a more favorable queen comes along. We also note in verse 15, we just read that actually, after that decree of Haman and the king, they're having some celebratory drinks together after they said, "We're going to go do this." It tells us that they sat down to drink. So Esther's really, really considering her position and the tenuousness of her position. And yet, despite it all, we have her say, "I will go into the king. And if I perish, I perish." Makes it all that more beautiful, the faith that she had. So chapter 5 really gets us to question, what is Esther doing? She's risking her life, clearly, by even going before the king. The king extends the scepter to her and says, even up to half the kingdom. We would think, well, here's her opportunity. Why doesn't she tell him right away? What is it that she, why isn't she immediately telling her story? Why doesn't he make her request? The king, in fact, asks her two times, what is your request? What is your petition? What's troubling you, Esther, he says. And then we have this last little bit in the chapter, inviting Haman to the party. Here again, in verse 6, the king asks, what's your petition? But she decides to invite them back for another night. And we want to just sort of try and understand what is she doing here? What is Esther trying to do? And to do that, we have to speculate a little bit, maybe a lot. But she obviously has some plan, some reason for her approach. And so we might suggest that this was part of her playing into the personalities of both her husband, her king, the king, and also the personality of Haman. Haman, we know, would have had to return home. And we know that he did return home, and he was feeling pretty proud at that time. He went home to brag to his wife and to his family. If you look at verse 9 of chapter 5, it says, Haman went out that day glad and pleased of heart. But he had to walk by this guy called Mordecai again. When Haman saw Mordecai at the king's gate, then he did not stand up or tremble before him. Haman was filled with anger against Mordecai. But Haman was able to control himself. He went to his house and sent for his friends and his wife, and then he recounted them all the glories of his riches. He was pretty proud of himself. And the queen not only wanted him to dine today, but tomorrow as well. But as sin does, has a way of overshadowing all of the blessings in our life, and Haman, despite his pleasure and self-importance, he mainly remembers his hatred towards this man Mordecai. Now, was that part of Esther's thinking? In having the party again tomorrow? To continue to have that grow? We know that the hatred at that time was only put to rest that night on orders to have gallows built. And the comfort that he would approach the king for the hanging of this man. And then the king. We come into chapter 6. The king couldn't sleep. Why couldn't the king sleep? And again, we've been speculating a bit, but parts of the book and events recorded for us, I think, leave us to speculate. And we wonder how safe the king feels in his own circumstances. I mean, after all, it was two of his own officials that were meant to guard his entrance to his, that were planning to kill him. I mean, that was a fairly close call for the king. Now this queen is acting fairly brave. Overly brave. Maybe he's extended a scepter and he asked him what she wanted. She doesn't tell him. Is she setting him up? What's she setting him up for? Why is this Haman guy being invited again by the queen to both banquets? Is there some other plot? And so what does he do? He asks for the book of records to be read. And we notice what part of those books are being read. That of the plot against him. He forgot to reward Mordecai. Was he concerned about the message that might send? That others would not bother letting him know that he was in trouble if he didn't reward them? The king determines to reward Mordecai. And who does he find when he decides to do this? In the middle of the night, walking in the king's court, he finds Haman. What is he doing there? Were more suspicions aroused? Well, we're not told, are we? But the king asks Haman, what should be done to honor someone? And what kind of a loaded question that must have been, right? What to say in all humbleness? Haman was thinking inside his head, right? Verse 6, whom would the king desire to honor more than me? Well, verse 7, for the man the king desires to honor, let them bring a royal robe, which the king has worn, and a horse on which he has ridden, and on whose head a royal crown has been placed. and let the robe and horse be handed over to one of the king's most noble princes, and let them array the man whom the king desires to honor, and lead him on horseback through the city square and proclaim before him, thus it shall be done to the man whom the king desires to honor. So, we can imagine the feelings of the circumstances of this man with a huge ego, having to lead lead Mordecai around the city on the king's horse with the king's crown, proclaiming, thus it shall be done to the man whom the king desires to honor. So the king and Haman come back a second day. The king now asks for the third time, what is your petition, Queen Esther? It shall be granted to you. What is your request? And we know it's here that Esther finally reveals her identity. And it's 4 years, 4 years into the marriage that she's kept that secret. And she points to Haman as that wicked man. And we find the king rising, and in his anger, he leaves the room, which has the effect of leaving Haman and Esther together. And upon the king's return, in verse 8, Haman's falling on the couch, begging Esther forgiveness. And the king sees this as an assault in Haman's actions. And at this point, one of the king's eunuchs informs the king that Haman had gallows built 50 cubits high, or 75 feet into the air, that were intended for Mordecai. And the king says, hang him on it instead. The rest of the book, as we said, moves quite quickly, because Esther's now revealed her kinship with Mordecai and is elevated and given Haman's position, who is over all the princes of the land. We also understand that once a law was put in place, that no one could repeal a law of the Medes and Persians. Therefore, the dilemma was that people were still to rise up against God's people. So they had to find another solution. The next decree allowed the Jews to take up arms and to defend themselves, to take plunder of those they fought. And we are told that there was now such dread that had fallen upon the people of the land that many among them became Jews. We also have the distinction in Esther chapter 8, I believe, of having the longest verse in the Bible. Esther chapter 8, verse 9, just a little tidbit for your information. If anyone has anyone longer, please come and let me know afterwards. I'll change that. So, chapters 9 and 10 will lump together. The Jews, we know that they in chapter 9, they were allowed to assemble together and defend themselves, and they laid hands on those who sought their harm. The Jewish tradition is that the Jews didn't want to seem overly zealous here in Susa. So they kept their killings in Susa, where the king was, in Mordecai, relatively minimal, 500 plus Haman's 10 sons. And the king asked Esther a little bit later in that chapter whether she had a further request. And she said, give us one more day here in Susa. The king granted that request, and the Jews killed another 300 on the next day. And they also hung the dead sons of Haman on the gallows. And overall, it tells us in all of the land that 75,000 were killed. Now, the Septuagint uses the number 15,000, which 75 seems quite high, but it doesn't, not one way or the other. But just for your information, the Septuagint does have a significantly lower number. But we also note that no plunder was ever taken, which the Jews didn't take advantage of the edict as Haman had first proposed. No doubt that those who were following Haman's edict, they would have used it to take plunder, but the Jews used it to defend themselves only. And finally, we come to the Feast of Purim. And the Jews to this day celebrate, they continue to celebrate Purim. And this year, Purim will be celebrated on March the 14th. There's a number of things that is commonly done. They read the Megillah Esther. Megillah is the Hebrew word for scroll. They also have festive meals, and they sing Purim songs, usually about that evil Haman and their hero Mordecai. They also have a dish that they call their, in their tongue, Haman's ears that they eat. And they also wear masks to hide their faces. But the reason why they hide their faces is because, again, we talked about Esther's, name being, meaning star in the Persian. The closest name is hidden. Esther hid her identity from the king. So I wasn't sure didn't think this was going to take quite this long to go through. But I thought we would just spend a moment thinking about what we personally can take from this book. Well, I think we can say that God is always at work as we do this study, whether we acknowledge him or not. We come to realize that God has acted in this piece of history to accomplish his purpose. And the main conclusion that we come to as we go through Esther, through a careful study, is that despite the absence of his name anywhere in the book, that God is and God does, and therefore God will continue to act through history to accomplish his purpose, regardless of whether the peoples of that particular age acknowledge him or not. And so while we might say that God is hidden in the story, we must also say his presence is evident beyond measure. And we note that he is using both children of promise and those outside his covenant as tools to accomplish that purpose. Thy will be done. Even though a nation has forgotten him, he is still faithful to his promise of unto thee and thy seed. We too are living in a foreign land amongst foreign people. We can easily get caught up in self-importance, like Haman, like thinking and seeking for worldly gain. But we must come to remember that our kingdom is not of this world and that we must seek a higher calling. Well, brothers and sisters, we hope this study has been helpful to you in building of our faith and in seeing God's providence at work for the sake of his people. And though it was directly hidden in the text of this book, it was plainly seen through our eyes of faith. I'm just going to grab my hymn book.